From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning. It is Friday, June the 26th, 2020, and we have an interesting show lined up for you this morning. We're going to be talking about Act 250 with someone who was there at its creation. Bruce Post of Essex is a former government official who worked for both Senators Jim Deffords and Bob Stafford, and also in state government. And he was there. He was at the scene of when Act 250 was created about a half century ago. Big changes coming with Act 250 in the Vermont legislature, likely this year. And there's a bill up, in fact, in the Senate. And Bruce Post has written a letter to senators asking them to go slow, reconsider, et cetera. We'll hear more details about that in just a moment. In the second half hour of the program this morning, we're going to be talking to a couple of longtime Vermont journalists about difficulties with transparency and with access to government meetings and so on in this age of Zoom technology. And Lisa Loomis, the editor of the Valley Reporter and president of the Vermont Press Association, will be joining us, along with Ross Connolly, who's a former editor and publisher of the Hardwick Gazette. Ross is now with the Hardwick Board of Library Trustees and has some concerns about how local government is doing its business online these days. And so we'll be bringing him into the conversation as well. Later on in the program this morning, after a conversation with one of our national correspondents, Bob Nay, will be joining us just after the 10 o'clock hour. And then we go to a conversation with Lisa Senecal and Carrie Brown of the Vermont Commission on Women. They see some disproportionate impacts on women, negative impacts, that is, from the coronavirus pandemic in terms of how the economy, the economic response has played out. More of a sociological thing, I guess, than an epidemiological thing. But we'll be getting into some of the details there in the second hour of the program this morning with the two of the leaders of the Vermont Commission on Women. That should be an interesting conversation as well. As always, we welcome calls to the program from our listeners. 244-1777 is the local number in Waterbury. The toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255 or 291-TALK. And I think we have Bruce Post with us on the phone right now. Bruce, are you there?
I'm here, Dave.
Excellent. Well, thank you for joining me on short notice this morning. We had another potential guest bow out at the last minute, and you were kind enough to say, sure, I'll pinch hit. And so here you are. And thanks again. So let's discuss this a little bit. Act 250, there's a bill that cleared the House, I think I saw back in late February, actually it was. And of course, then everything went into a freeze frame for a while with the legislature. As I guess thawed out with the warm weather recently, and they're back in business, and they're the Act 250 is now the subject of a lot of discussion in the Vermont Senate. Can you update me on where things are? Is there a bill up today, or what's happening?
Well, I understand there is something coming up today, very possibly. Some other folks that have monitored the legislative progress a lot better than I have, as hard as it is over Zoom or whatever they use, or YouTube, might have a better insight on all the legislative nuances of the legislation and how they proceeded in the Senate Natural Resources and Energy Committee. I think, first of all, you thank me for pinch hitting, and so I hope I'm not like the mighty Casey, and that I'll strike out. I hope to have a solid hit here. I want to read something to you, Dave, first, very short snippet. It's a part of some testimony I submitted to Senator Bray. I don't think it's ever been posted, and that's another issue I guess people have.
Senator Chris Bray is the chair of the Senate Natural Resources and Energy Committee. He's a Democrat from Addison County, and he would be the key person in the Senate on this Act 250 legislation.
Yep, and I this was on the part of my testimony, and I introduced it by saying truth tellers seem in short supply, but 25 years ago on the State House lawn, a younger Senator Dick McCormick nailed it. Like a tipsy troubadour crashing a teetotaler's convention, he spoke an inconvenient truth. Vermont's pretensions of environmental virtue were overblown. And here's exactly what Dick McCormick said 25 years ago when they were celebrating this, the 25th anniversary of Act 250. He was there. It was on the State House lawn, evidently. And he said, people pay more lip service to the environment than ever before. But the reality is that step by step, we are retreating from our commitment to protect it. And I think Dick McCormick was right then. And those words can be applied manifoldly today about what's unveiling in the legislature. I followed the House process a lot more because those were actual meetings. You know, you could attend. The Senate thing is held under the understandable restrictions brought about by the COVID virus. But I've looked in on a few meetings here and there of my select board or the Senate, and it's certainly less than optimum, and it enables a lot of things to be pushed through that would normally get a little bit more attention if you could have people in the room. So that's my introductory remarks. And one of the things I said in my the testimony that I sent that evidently wasn't posted, I titled it Keeping Our Promises to the Green Mountains. Back in the late 60s, Vermont Life actually had an ad promoting Vermont. It had a beautiful picture of Camel's Hump, and it said, we made a promise to this mountain. And actually, there was a promise made to Camel's Hump to protect it. It's the only one of our big mountains over 4,000 feet that really haven't been spoiled by real estate development and ski area sprawl. And I was wondering if we'd keep that promise today. And I just think we're making too many compromises, too many retreats. Language that on the surface may look helpful if you look at details from what I understand from some of my friends really doesn't measure up. And there's almost a philosophy embedded in this whole process. Well, this is the best we can do. I think Senator Bray was quoted as saying we have to balance the environment and the economy. Well, heck, the chambers of commerce have been saying that for as long as there's been the Industrial Revolution. And if anything's been losing, it's the it's been the environment and certainly not the economy. So to hear that said by a Senate chair of natural resources was, if true, pretty disturbing to me.
Well, I'm wondering what are some of the I have actually lost track of this myself and have not kept up well enough. And of course, I was working on short notice this morning, too, so I haven't had a chance to do a lot of research. But last I checked in on the Act 250 legislation was in late February. And the this is when it passed the House by a vote of 88-52. I'm looking at a VT Digger story from back then, and they gave preliminary approval almost 3 years after lawmakers formally began a review to, on how to modernize Act 250 in advance of its 50th anniversary. Representative Amy Sheldon of Middlebury, whom I may have to get back on the show here to get her to bring us up to date here sometime in the next week or so. So I'm gonna work on that. She was talking about releasing Vermont town and village centers from review. That's been from Act 250 review, and that has been a sort of a central plank in this legislation all along, is to try to make it easier for development to happen in already settled areas. What do you know, Bruce Post, about that? And do you think that that's people talk a lot about encouraging development in our town and village centers and trying to keep forest land, farmland, et cetera, out in the hills open. Has that been the spirit of Act 250? Has it worked well? And does this legislation really enable it to continue? Or is this more lip service and actually allow a lot of damage to those principles?
Well, first, Dave, can I ask you a question first? Because you raised, you mentioned a term. What do you mean? What do you think they mean by modernize Act 250? I have no clue.
Well,
how about you?
I think terminology in politics is often a malleable thing. And
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, George Orwell wrote a great essay about the debasement of the English language by politicians. But this is what gets me. Yes, I know that the executive director of VNRC has been a big proponent of what they call smart growth. And I've read essays by scholars who say that smart growth is still dumb growth. But it's about suspending Act 250 coverage, not only in downtowns, I guess village centers. And from some of my colleagues who have looked at this, says it has all sorts of precedent for releasing people who have been, whose projects have been subject to Act 250 jurisdiction. They might be able to go and appeal and get released from it. But this whole question of modernization is a real mystery to me. I mean, look at what's happening, for instance, on Lake Champlain, okay? Largely from our larger towns, Burlington, even Montpelier, Vergennes, Rutland, sewer overflows dumped into the lake. Why is that happening? And we could say, yeah, rains are heavy, but we've been dealing with this issue for years, and it seems they're still occurring. Well, if we're going to allow more development and make it easier, okay, make it easier to happen in our cities to build up and put more people in, that's going to put more pressure on the infrastructure. Evidently, we're not doing a good enough job today. So that's one thing that I do think that needs great attention and also high standards. And if you look around, you can see the reports. James Ellers, who's been with the Lake Champlain Committee or whatever group he's with that holds the fishing derby, Lake Champlain International, I think it's called, has done a lot of work on this. I think he has a perspective on it. But this is more of that stuff where we paint this beautiful picture of Vermont, but you scratch underneath it, and there's a lot of spoilation. So, yes, downtown development and smart growth or clusters was part of an attempt by the Cunin administration back when Governor Cunin was governor. She convened this commission on Vermont's future. Doug Kostel, who used to run the EPA and that had moved to Vermont, I think, with Vermont Law School, chaired it. There were hearings on television, everything. And when I was Governor Snelling's planning director, the state had still not issued regulations for it. And we had started meetings. I was meeting with the then head of VNRC when Governor Snelling died. So we never got around to it. But if we're going to, I mean, that's the interesting thing, too, that environmental organizations seem to have turned into mini chambers of commerce where growth, promotion of growth, continues to be on their agenda. And quite frankly, growth is a problem. There's a belief that we can decouple environmental damage from increased growth. And there's a lot of scholarly research that says you can't, that growth does eventually overburden the environment, and we have to be careful about it.
You know, it's been interesting to me to watch this stuff over the last 30 or 35 years you know, most of which I was a reporter in Vermont, and you'd watch economic booms and busts come, and it was always during economic booms that suddenly growth became a real concern. And I always had the sense that there were just these gigantic piles of money stacking up in places like New York and Boston, and that a little bit enough would spill off the top of those piles to kind of make its way up into Vermont and start having a big impact here on stuff getting built. You know, capital tends to look for projects to invest in, and so here are some nice green hills. We can build some new stuff.
I mean, look at what's happened with our ski areas. Look what happened with Jay Peak. You know, we now have roller coasters on some of our ski areas. I think Kimo's got one. They call it the Thunder Ripper or something like that. The Killington may have something. You've got a water park at Jay Peak in the mountains that actually passed Act 250 review and was approved, that seems like some sort of spaceship has descended out of nowhere and landed in our mountains. And mountains are inherently ecologically sensitive regions. And while we have the 2,500-foot rule that exists today, folks like Hub Vogelman, the great botanist, the late great botanist at UVM, who really raised Vermont's consciousness about the mountains, admits that really that there was some science involved in it, but was so affected by the politics. He said, how low can we really go? There were discussions about setting that line at 1,500 feet, which Dean Davis himself mentioned as a very sensitive height for protecting our mountain streams and the headwaters of our rivers. So there have been, you know, science has been compromised, I think, continually, and now it seems we're looking at selective science. Let me add one thing about out-of-state capital coming to Vermont. You know, mm-hmm. where you see that? You see that in a lot of these huge solar farms, and you see it on our mountaintops with some of these large wind projects that Iberdrola, or Avangrid, they call, you know, is headquartered, I think, in Spain. It's as almost as if these generals in Europe and other places are moving little pins across a map looking for targets of opportunity, and Vermont is one, and we've seen it. And one of the big wind developers, a native-born son of Vermont, says to meet our energy standards, renewable energy standards, we need to build 200 miles of ridgetop wind with the attendant roads and everything else to meet our standards. Well, again, my friend Charles Johnson, you may know Charles, lives in Montpelier, the former state naturalist, says that the most sensitive part of our ecology in the state is at the top of the mountains, and we seem so ready to compromise it and excuse it. And somehow, when you say modernize Act 250, and then it really excuses this kind of development because, well, we have to be au courant, you know, we have to be up with the times. Well, you know, there are certain principles of ecology that are eternal and that they can't be compromised just because you want to be modern and with it.
Well, that's it's pretty
here this morning, Dave.
Age-old debate here in Vermont. You know, I mean, I was thinking about your remarks concerning Jay Peak's water park, and I was just, well, you know, there are people who earn some wages building that thing. There are people who earn some wages running it. Monitoring the kids in the pools and et cetera. What about that? I mean, people talk about we need to use some of our lands in terms of just promoting economic growth and providing jobs, and I mean, do you see that, or do you think that we are already bending way too far in that direction?
Well, first of all, let's talk about Jay Peak and all those quote jobs. So many of them are temporary. So many of them are poor paying. You know, that was done under that rather sordid EB-5 program, and they had to, I think one of the rules was that, you know, they had to create, for every 10 investors or something, they had to create a full-time job or something like that, you know. And I remember Pat Leahy, who was a big promoter of it, actually introduced legislation to sort of even weaken that standard and basically said, for instance, if you have a feather pillow in the in Jay Peak that is produced by a company in Nebraska, but it's somehow part of that EB-5 scam, and that created 10 jobs in a feather pillow factory in Nebraska, that counted towards the credit for job production under EB-5 up at Jay Peak. So there's a, what did George Bush call it, or Al Gore said something, fuzzy math? Fuzzy math? Well, there's a lot of fuzzy math about this stuff. And but eventually, too, you have to draw a line. You have to say, no more. Yes, you go down to Stratton, sprawl everywhere, multi-million-dollar homes. I have a friend of mine, the late Neil Houston, was Senator Stafford's chief of staff for years, and Senator Stafford had an exemplary environmental record, and particularly crucial at the national level. Neil's son was a carpenter at the time, building a lot of these fancy homes at ski areas, and Neil used to say, my son can't afford a home himself. So, you know, there you go.
That's a, yeah.
There, that, that there is, two that, or that's, maybe, yes, go ahead.
I was just going to say that that's a huge issue in Vermont and elsewhere right now. But I mean, it's you know, the places that are being built here, new housing is a rare thing in Vermont, and you know, I see prices for new housing. I think I saw one just recently that was starting at $385,000. For to get into a, you know, a single family home, basically. And if you add up average incomes in Vermont and you have a two income couple, that's still a stretch. You know, that's in terms of affordability or lack thereof.
Absolutely.
And so nobody is really looking at, you know, what are average incomes for, you know, say, 25 to 30 year olds right now in Vermont, and saying what kind of housing can we build that they can afford. And
I was on another station recently because I asked a question about affordability in Vermont and what was behind it, and one of the issues that comes out of it is this whole question of averages. Okay, average income, average cost of housing. Well, there was a physician at UVM, Larry Weed, who talked about how he hated cookbook medicine because it was designed for the average patient. And he said to me, there's no such thing as an average patient. Well, there is no such thing as an average Vermonter. There are people who are doing really well, and there are people who aren't doing so well. Put them all in the same pot, and you come up with an average. And averages can be very deceiving and not be a true portrayal of the situation that affect a lot of people in this state.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, this whole discussion about Vermont's ability to maintain its pristine environment and rural nature and all of this versus its ability to keep a vibrant economy going, I think is one that is manifested in many, many different ways over and across years, decades, really. We've been having these debates in Vermont. I suspect that they will go on for decades to come. I mean, it's just a kind of a perennial. And I mean, if you, Bruce Post, were to look forward, say, to 2050, right? Tell me, you know, will Vermont maintain a difference from other states, say, in 2050?
Well,
or does it have one now?
In some ways, in some ways we will be different, in other ways we won't. You know, look at Burlington and Chittenden County. You know, I remember years ago we used to call it Westchester North after the wealthy suburbs, you know, Westchester County, north of New York City. And it's getting more and more like that. It's certainly out of step or a contrast with the rest of Vermont, with density housing and things like this that could, you know, and you suspending the rules, you could that could lead to a lot of, some will say housing investment, others might say housing speculation, where you're building for a relatively affluent market with some breadcrumbs tossed aside for affordable housing. You know, Dave, I don't know how much time we have left. I just want to read you two
quotes. Just a couple minutes.
I want to read you two quotes to demonstrate what I think is the regression of our environmental commitment and the deterioration of it. And this is Dean Davis in 1970. He said, "Humans are indeed an inescapable part of an intricate system of life and growth that begins with air, soil, and water, and includes myriad forms of life and activity upon which we are mutually dependent." Dean Davis, 1970. Here's a quote from Peter Shumlin in 2013 that was reported in the Commons, which is down in Brattleboro. He met with people in Grafton. They had to corner him because they had the big wind project going on down there, and he was trying to avoid them. But they quoted him as saying, "Birds, bats, and bears are expendable in the effort to keep the planet safe." So can you imagine a planet without birds, bats, and bears, and just human beings? That, to me, exemplifies
how... Bruce, I got to go, but listen, I really thank you very much for joining me this morning, and let's talk again soon. And a fascinating perspective with a lot of years in Vermont. We'll be back in a couple of minutes, folks.
A pitch hitter.
Nah, you didn't. You got a hit. Thanks.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Welcome back, folks. We are going to be talking in this next segment of the Dave Graham Show today about transparency, or lack thereof, government transparency, in particular in the age of the COVID-19 virus, when so much business is being transacted by electronic means, I should say, an awful lot of government meetings, both at the local and state level here in Vermont, being conducted via an online technology called Zoom, which is kind of a cool thing. You can be sitting in your home and and actually log in and sign up and participate in a meeting, but there are limitations, and they are starting to chafe. There are limitations on who can get in and what the process is for getting in. Is it as free and open as the old public meeting where you just go down to town hall on the right night of the week and take in your select board meeting or planning commission meeting or whatever? It turns out there are some intervening steps, and we're going to be talking about them. We have a couple of longtime Vermont journalists joining us in this next 25-minute segment here on the Dave Graham Show. And Lisa Loomis is the editor of the Valley Reporter, which covers the Mad River Valley here, just part of the key part of the WDEV listening area. And Lisa is president of the Vermont Press Association. She's on the line with us. Good morning, Lisa. Thanks so much for joining me.
Good morning, Dave. I'm happy to be here.
Good. And Ross Connolly is the former editor of the Hardwick Gazette. I believe he gave that property or sold that property or transferred that property in some fashion to new people about 3 years ago or so, but had been a journalist up in the Hardwick area for a long time, and now is a member of the Hardwick, I believe it's the Board of Library Trustees, and as a member of that board, there, he has had some concerns about how local business is being transacted via these internet technologies. And Ross Connolly, welcome to the program this morning. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Dave. Glad to be here.
And Lisa, let me start with you, if I could, because it sounds to me like you have had some experience in dealings on this issue with at both the local level and, if I'm right, maybe the state level as well, in terms of trying to follow some developments in the legislature. Tell us a little bit about what you have heard and seen.
So on the state level, there have been numerous instances throughout the spring and early summer where there were technical glitches that prevented live streaming or prevented public access. And in a couple of instances, there was one instance where the legislative council was shut out of a meeting for a bill that you're supposed to write. There's been instances where testimony is given and the first 5 minutes of the testimony don't show up on the record. And there's often, and this is somewhat troublesome, there's pre-meeting chatter that's going on before the recording starts and before people are being let into the Zoom meetings. And that is public business being discussed without the public having access to it. That's very worrisome. And we're all going through our first pandemic, so I'm not suggesting that there's bad intent here, but I'm suggesting that there needs to be a bit more redundancy in the technology. So if somebody gets cut off, the work stops, and that person, whether it's a reporter or a member of the public, is allowed back in either via Zoom or somebody calls them on their cell phone. We just need to do a better job of this. And that's at the state level. We're seeing the same thing at the local level.
Yeah, and you know, when you say you don't want to allege any bad intent on people's parts, I will say that, you know, I covered the State House for decades for the Associated Press, and occasionally, if people did want to, say, include a provision in legislation which they had a feeling was not going to be popular, there were techniques for doing that in ways, you know, you waited until most people were out of the room, basically. That was a key. And occasionally you do have some deals go down which are maybe not thoroughly vetted or maybe not completely in the public interest and maybe they wouldn't happen if they had more sunlight shown on them, and all of those kinds of activities that had some taint of too much secrecy or just not enough sunlight. All of those activities were adapted to a system which basically depended on in-person committee meetings and in-person floor action, et cetera, in the legislature. Now you layer over this new technology, Zoom, and it seems as though the people who want to do business that way are pretty darn adaptable.
Yeah,
and they're going to figure out how to maximize advantage, et cetera, in this new era, right?
Right. That's why good journalists stay till the last dog is hung and get there before anything starts, right? I'm sure you did that when you were covering the State House.
Tried to.
You know, we've seen locally we've had issues with, for example, the Waterbury Select Board was using a version of Zoom that only allowed a certain number of participants, so when our reporter couldn't get on one night. We've had a select board hold a meeting by conference call outside in the parking lot of the town offices, and they were all appropriately distant from each other. But the result was anybody calling in couldn't hear. I must have interrupted the meeting 25 times to say, who said that? Please say that again, because it was impossible to hear. We've had issues where people are joining Zoom meetings. You know, if you're on a meeting with someone and they call in by a cell phone, you're only seeing a cell phone number. You're not seeing, for example, when I use Zoom, my name shows up in the little box that is me, so I can see who my name is. So people are making comments at public hearings, and there's no way to know who they are. And we've had an issue with our local school board where a man who is often a squeaky wheel at in-person school boards was not recognized when he tried to speak several times during the public comment section because it's completely up to the moderator to decide. So it's not a perfect technology by any means.
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting point you make there, Lisa, which is that a lot of times public meetings, whether at the community level or at the state level, are can be run a little less smoothly than might be ideal in some people's perspectives because they invite gadflies. You know, they basically attract people who have particular bones to pick sometimes, and sometimes with good reason, sometimes with maybe less good reason. But the access to meeting law is not written. Or is written in a way that is supposed to be completely neutral toward the content of the message anyone is trying to share. And so when you start getting really subjective about it, and when the moderator thinks to him or herself, this person's a pain in the neck, I really don't like them, and then bases their rulings about whom to recognize right now on with a lot of that sentiment in mind, that's where things really start to go awry, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I do agree, because if you were in the town offices at the select board room or at the school board room, the chair would turn and say, okay, it's time for public comment, and recognize people. And the squeaky wheel with his hand raised, the public and the public access television would see that. Mm-hmm. He was excluded.
Yeah. And you normally see the rolling eyeballs and the sort of shuffling around when that person starts speaking. I know how that stuff works, you know. But on the other hand, sometimes the person is, you know, makes an important point, and one which even if the majority didn't initially want to hear it, it ends up having an impact of some kind.
Right. That person has a right to speak.
Yep. Hey, Ross Connolly, I want to bring you in on the conversation because you have an interesting perspective here as a longtime journalist in Vermont and someone who is now, after a fashion anyway, involved in local government, I gather. Did I get it right that you are on the Hardwick Board of Library Trustees?
Yes, the Jude Devine Memorial Library and Board of Trustees. I was elected at town meeting this year, so I'm a newbie with regard to serving on the board and the capacity as a public official now as opposed to a journalist, but you did get that right. One of the issues that I'm concerned about, you and Lisa have been talking about once people are in the meeting, I'm concerned about getting into the meeting. The public records or public meeting law is clear, and I guess the legislature did amend the law this past session to state that the public body shall allow attendance by telephone whenever possible, and the body must publicly post information on how to access meetings electronically and include the information on the agenda for the meeting. And to me, that right there is it's clear, but it's not clear. When they say include that information on the agenda for the meeting, what does that mean? And the reason I raise that question, on our library board at our last regular meeting, we had an amendment to our bylaw where we say we had to conform to the Vermont open meeting law, and electronic meetings are allowed when the situation prohibits in-person meetings, and with access to electronic meetings to be duly provided to community members. And so what does duly provided mean, and what does include that information on the agenda mean? And I raised the question at our library board meeting, and I said, I think that should be specific and state the Zoom access numbers should be made available on the agenda. It's posted, or just very specific. And concern I've heard has been raised about, well, you know, we're concerned about having a Zoom meeting and getting Zoom bombed. You know, that's a legitimate concern that somebody has either in your town or from who knows where decides to Zoom bomb a meeting, come in, disrupt it with, you know, inappropriate comments, visuals, whatever. I mean, there have been many instances of this, and it's It's not good.
Yeah, well, a lot of our listeners aren't familiar, Ross. So what is Zoom bombing? Define that for us.
Well, Zoom bombing is when you're in a meeting, I'm in a meeting, and somebody has gained access to the Zoom access numbers so they can attend, so to speak, that meeting electronically. And their sole intent in coming into that meeting is to disrupt it in whatever way they choose, whether it's verbally to put, I mean, there have been things, people putting pornographic things so that it appears on the screen so that everybody who's attending that meeting electronically sees these things. And it's obviously very disruptive. You know, it's not the way to conduct oneself. One to be expected in a public body, in a civic situation. And
hasn't that changed? I thought that the ability for meetings to be Zoom bombed had been tightened up, and if you used a password and
there's no question it has, but that past practice, if you will, is still there. And so one of the things that some board members have posted on their agendas for a meeting, contact the board chair, the town clerk, or whatever, to get the Zoom access numbers. And I know one reporter who was sent the Zoom access numbers by either the select board chair or the town clerk, with just a note that the public needs to call the town clerk to get those access numbers. So there's separating out, they're making two categories, the press and the public. Well, the press is part of the public. And so if the press is given the Zoom access number, why isn't the public?
Have you had any sort of response to your, as you raise this concern locally that we ought to have access to meeting codes by the general public as part of when they post the agenda, it ought to say here's how to come to the meeting, basically, as opposed to just call your town clerk for the password?
Well, no, I haven't personally. I mean, we discussed it at our library board meeting. I know there's another board in town that it says if you want to get access to the meeting, contact the general manager of the department, and you can get that access. I mean, my concern is with all good intent, I won't disparage or question the motives, that there might be negative motives, but it's more the practical obstacle that's being set up if you have to call or email a public official to request the access numbers. They are required under the public meeting law to post the agenda for the meeting. So, you know, you've got the agenda, whether it's a select board or planning board or whatever, and it states the date and the time of the meeting and the items to be discussed, and it normally would have the telephone number of the town. Well, say you're coming back from work and you run by the post office to grab your mail, and it's 5 o'clock or 5:30, and you see the notice of the agenda of the particular meeting. Oh, darn, I wanted to go to that meeting, and it doesn't have any way to go to the meeting, and because it's not listed, the Zoom numbers aren't listed, and here it's 5:30, and you call the town office, but the town office is closed, so you can't get through. You send an email. Somebody in the town office is not there to read the email, so you were basically denied access to that meeting, as opposed to if the numbers, the Zoom numbers were posted on the agenda, you could go home, sit down at your computer, type in those numbers, and join the meeting at 6 o'clock or whenever it begins. And
well, let me stop you for a sec, though, and ask you. So there is this issue of trying to control access and prevent Zoom bombing, right? If you post the code to the meeting publicly, that really and it's on the internet, that basically allows anybody and everybody access, and including bad actors. Is that a risk that folks just have to live with?
Well, I think in one sense, yes, because anybody is the public, if you will. And because of the internet, anybody here or across the country or the other side of the world can access something. A normal meeting, somebody may come into the meeting and sit in the back of the room and then start to hector the board. And so you deal with that when it happens. The chair bangs the gavel, says, "You're out of order. Please sit down and refrain." And if the person insists, well, you might have to call some security to come in and ask the person to be removed. You deal with it when it happens. You don't go in anticipation, "Oh, this might happen," and restrict the access. And that's the thing, the Zoom number, making it public, we run that risk. But,
that's the way it goes. Yep. Hey, I got to interrupt again. Sure. Got to interrupt again because, sorry, but we are fast approaching the top of the hour, which actually means the end. We're out of time on this segment of the Dave Graham Show. I want to thank my guests. Lisa Loomis is the editor of the Valley Reporter and president of the Vermont Press Association. Ross Connolly, the former editor and publisher of the Hartford Gazette. Thank the two of you very much for joining me this morning.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Dave, and nice talking to you both.
Take care, Ross. We're going to head into a top of the hour break for some CBS News here on the Dave Graham Show. And on the return, we'll be talking with our friend Bob Ney and then two folks from the Vermont Women's Commission about the COVID impact on women's economic issues, etc.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Thanks for staying with us into the second hour of our program on this Friday, June the 26th. And what a beautiful June the 26th it is. We are going to be talking in a moment with Bob Ney. And Bob Ney's a guy. Sorry. I really got to get in the habit of not trying to do two things at once here while I'm on the air, because I end up goofing things up. But anyway, now that we've wasted a little time doing that, we now have Bob Ney on the air. And Bob, good morning. How are you?
Hey. Hi, Dave.
I was talking about you, and I was reading an email at the same time, or a text or something, and I referred to you as she. I don't think you're a she, so anyway.
I've kind of decided that a long time ago.
Hey, so I wanted to check in with other news headlines this morning with you, and what's your top story today?
Well, there's a lot of stories. There's some, international stories, but I think the top domestic story is about the Trump administration petitioning as a friend of the court, basically, to try to do away with the American Care Act, the ACA. And that may be decided this fall. So the president may get a wish that he really doesn't want.
How would that play for him politically? Is that a big win for his base? Is it a big win for him? He's been promising that since he was campaigning for this job, and now he's coming into his fourth year, or he's in his fourth year as president, and maybe he would get this, and then what?
Well, the base that has insurance, it'll be okay. But I will tell you this, there are Republicans out there, because healthcare doesn't sit there and say, "Well, you're a Republican, you're a Democrat, I'll go with you and I won't go with you." There are a lot of people that will be in severe trouble, and will have no option, actually, except to probably leave their jobs and go on human services or Medicaid. And that goes contrary to what supposedly the president stands for. I think it will be a disaster for him if this comes true. There will be millions of people out in the cold. And again, these people, these are also working people in America, because if you're not working, you know, and if your income's a certain level, you go on Medicaid, you could, you know, or human services. These are people that are out there working. So this would be a penalty. Now, I admit there's flaws in the ACA from day one, you know, all kinds of flaws, but nobody changed it. It sat here, you know, all this time. And if that court decides, Dave, before the election, and all of a sudden millions of people are out on the street cold with no health care, I will tell you, I think it would make a disastrous November for him.
Well, and suppose the court doesn't rule the way he wants it to. Will his intent to have that happen, will that hurt him?
Well, now that's the jackpot question, I think. You know, if they rule against him, then he, quote, tried for the base that, you know, wasn't happy with ACA or Obamacare, whichever you want to call it. But probably if people, you know, are not cut out of their health care, they'll move on to the next topic they care about with Trump. You know, now if they're cut out of their health care, that's going to inflame everything.
Yeah, I guess it really is a bottom line question. Do I have health insurance or do I not? You know, can I afford to get health care when I need it? And this, of course, comes at a pretty fraught time, because so many people, are having been laid off from their jobs, are then without health insurance that they were getting from, in many cases, from their employers. So there's that. And then, by the way, there's this little pandemic going around, and ventilators aren't cheap from what I hear.
Right. I mean, I know of a case, by the way, a big time Trump supporter in Florida. I personally know of his case. He's struggling right now just to keep his head above water. He's on the exchange with, you know, ACA, but his medical insurance or prescription costs are $800 a month. He has a $5,800 buy down. So these are some of the flaws. But if he does, he has a pre-existing condition. So if he doesn't have health care, you know, his option is probably to quit his job, go to zero income, and go on Medicaid.
Wow, that's a tough spot. I mean, I don't, and you know, you multiply that by the number of Americans who have similar stories, and it really does start to have a serious impact on you know, our overall society and economy and stuff. And you know, I don't know. It's just it would seem kind of ironic here if that were the outcome. I certainly hope it isn't, for the sake of people's individual health care and the idea that, you know, we want to keep people as healthy as possible. And in the workforce, that's important to our economy, is to have healthy employees showing up for work every day, or most days anyway. Yikes. What a talk to me a little bit about the president's rationale. Why does he want to get rid of the ACA? And then we'll talk about whether the court, you know, what the legal tea leaves are indicating right now. But first of all, what's the argument for doing what the president wants to do?
You know, I'm not sure. I mean, I guess it's a play to some of the base, some of them. I guess it's that type of thing, or he's trying to get a headline. But honestly, politically, don't forget public policy for a second and what's right or wrong, but politically, it's just bad timing. I really cannot figure out why he would want to do this at this point in time with everything else going down. It's bad advice, bad thinking, something.
Well, I mean, I guess part of it is some of it might be kind of he's been advocating getting rid of the ACA for a long time promising he's going to replace it with something much, much better. So far, we haven't really seen anything much better take shape, or really anything at all take shape. So that, I don't know where that's going, but I mean, he might be in a bit of a jam here, because since he's been calling for gutting the ACA since before he was president, all of a sudden here we are in 2020, and we do have this pandemic going on. We do have this economic upset going on. You know, anybody who likes the ACA will say we need it more now than ever. And the president isn't one much to change his positions on things. So it would be difficult for him suddenly to say, oh, yeah, you know, now that we do have this pandemic and we do have this economic crash, maybe we ought to stick with the ACA for a while longer or something. I mean, I guess that would that be a face losing thing for him, or what do we think?
Well, it would be. Look, the ACA, and, you know, you and I could spend a lot of time to talk about the flaws of the ACA. And there are flaws. There are serious yep. flaws of the ACA. Mm-hmm. It's not a public option. It's private sector insurance. You know, rates are horrible high, et cetera. But having said that, what's the alternative? Because if the pre-existing condition clause goes, and you have some type of pre-existing condition, you're going to walk up to get insurance, and somebody's going to say, yeah, I'll give it to you. How about $2,000 a month? How do you like that premium? Then you're not going to do it. Then, of course, something happens major. The hospital's going to eat the costs. You're going to hurt when it comes to certain prescriptions. And it's a nightmare. Now, I don't know what Roberts will do. Roberts, of course, stuck up for the ACA because of the nature of, quote, the tax, you know, that they wrote into the bill. Justice Roberts, I don't know what he'll do this time. You can never second guess the Supreme Court. I think we found that out, you know, a couple of times this year.
Yeah. Yeah. That is really, really interesting. You know, and I think that the president, as you say, he may live to regret this advocacy for eliminating the ACA. But that may just be the way the cookie crumbles. You know, and actually, we had an interesting conversation on the air here yesterday with a political science professor who was talking about how, you know, people worry about extreme politics if either party gains control of the House, the Senate, and the White House all at the same time. I made the note that you know, the last time that happened with the Democrats was early in the Obama administration, and you know, they didn't pass single payer. They didn't even pass a public option. They passed this thing that I think I've read was originally proposed by the Heritage Foundation and then adopted in Massachusetts by then Governor Mitt Romney. So a fairly Republican, if you're going to do health care reform of any kind, a fairly Republican leaning version of it, one would think. And so I'm just wondering, Does that put the lie to this idea that, let me state it in a more positive way. Does that tell us something about regression to the mean, you know, sort of everything collapsing toward the middle position in American politics, even if we talk about how polarized we are and how everybody's an extremist these days?
Well, it does collapse to the middle. I have friends right now who are true progressives who are privately fuming. Because, look, Joe Biden is not a progressive candidate. I mean, people can argue Joe Biden. He is not Elizabeth Warren. He is not Bernie Sanders. So they're sitting there saying, okay, well, then maybe he'll do the progressive cause, quote. And as I tell them, of course, you know, I know Biden. I serve with him. But Biden will tend to go to the middle. He's been there for 30 years. You know, he will tend to go to the middle. Now, Trump was all over the place, left, right, middle, you know, wherever. But I still think things do tend to go to the middle, which actually can anger, I guess, both sides, couldn't it?
I guess, you know, when I just joke with my progressive friends, you're going to be biding your time until AOC turns 35 and 24.
Right, exactly.
But that is apparently the shape of things. Anyway, Bob Ney, I got to get, but thank you very much for joining me this morning.
You.
And we'll talk to you next week. I wanted to introduce my next pair of guests. We have two folks on from the Vermont Commission on Women talking about the disparate economic impacts and sort of sociological impacts of the COVID-19 crisis on women. Joining me are the chair of the Vermont Commission on Women, Lisa Senecal. And Lisa, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Carrie Brown is the executive director of the same group, the Vermont Commission on Women, also joining us. And Carrie, thank you for participating as well.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Sure. And so, Lisa, let me start with you. This is interesting. I'm just looking at some of the data here, and we're talking about when I first was thinking about the different impacts of the COVID-19 crisis on women versus men, I was thinking, are women more likely to contract the disease? Are there different outcomes in terms of people who actually do contract the disease, et cetera, et cetera? Turns out we're not really talking about epidemiology here, are we? We're talking more about economics and sociology, right?
Right. I don't think we have enough of the medical information at this point to know, certainly know whether or not there is a difference in the rate of transmission between men and women. But we do know that men seem to have a higher mortality rate. But the impact that we're really looking at are a lot of the economic, the social impacts that are just hitting women harder than they are men, and they're going to be the same things that are more difficult to come back out of when the pandemic is behind us.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that we have all heard much about in recent months is just the role being played by, for instance, some of our essential workers, particularly in the healthcare fields. And it is striking when you look at the statistics that you folks have come up with here on how those roles are mainly played by women in Vermont. 91% of nurses in Vermont are women, 82% of other healthcare workers in Vermont who are women, and 82% of personal care workers, including child care professionals in Vermont, who are women. And so that really tells us that an awful lot of the labor, frankly, that occurs in the healthcare sector, and an awful lot of the instances of someone having direct contact, perhaps with someone who is sick with the coronavirus, those direct contacts, the people who are providing that care, are largely women. So talk about that disparity and what that has meant right off the bat.
Sure. The other group that isn't touched on there is just low-wage workers overall. And we know that women make up a larger percentage of low-wage workers in Vermont than men do. And many of those low-wage workers were considered essential workers. So they were also, or still are, out there having increased exposure that higher wage workers who are much more likely to be working from home are not having to deal with. Yes, the healthcare sector is, especially in nursing and general healthcare workers within the hospital setting, not doctors, they're much more heavily female than they are male. We know that the exposure of these folks is much higher. And, you know, at least for quite a while, there was a lot of difficulties getting the personal protective equipment that folks needed. So they were at a higher risk because of that. And it's not just the actual physical risk that they were having to bear, but it has meant tremendous emotional, psychological weight that they have been carrying, to not only know that they are at risk, but that because they're at greater risk when they go home to their families, they have an increased concern that they're going to be exposing family members to that. But they're there and they're showing up to work because their deep commitment to the work that they're doing, and also because their income is very important to the survival of their family economically.
So you mentioned non-healthcare fields. I mean, we were talking about healthcare initially, but many, many other fields. You refer to them as the low wage fields, essentially. But when you think about wait staff in restaurants, you think about a lot of the staffing in our lodging establishments. They are disproportionately affected by essentially shutdowns of those industries. I mean, we have our restaurant industry has been largely shut down in recent months, as have our lodgings. And talk about a disparate impact on women. I see this figure in your report indicating that women make up 81% of the state's tipped wage earners, the highest rate in the country. Four out of five people who rely on tips for some of their income, and I would gather that includes people who clean hotel rooms and people who wait tables, are women, and so you can see where the impact there would be much bigger.
Absolutely, yeah. So women are simultaneously overrepresented in some of those essential positions, but then also overrepresented in some of the low-wage jobs in the areas that have been hit the hardest, such as hospitality, restaurants, retail. And so the number of unemployment claims has just skyrocketed for everybody, of course, but much, much more for women than for men in Vermont. So the report that we have here has the April numbers, but the May numbers just came out, and it's even higher in May. So back in our report in April, we saw that 46% of unemployment claims were from women and 40% from men. So it was higher for women than for men. But in April, it's up to 56.7% of the unemployment claims are from women, compared to 43.3% for men. So it's climbing proportionately for women. And then also when you compare those figures to a year ago, back in May of 2019, men were filing many more unemployment claims than women. So that's sort of the norm, is that, you know, you have more men on unemployment. So that switched now. And then you look at the overall percentage increase. For men, it's gone up about 1,300% in the last year, which is, you know, a horrifying number. But for women, it's gone up about 2,100%. So really dramatically more. Yeah.
That is. Go ahead, Lisa.
Sorry, just to add to that, and what economists are seeing also is that in the recession that we had in 2008, that tended to hit men more heavily than women because it was the higher salaried jobs that disappeared at a higher rate than the tipped workers in the low wage positions. And that's not what we're seeing this time. And not only is it the jobs that are predominantly held by women that have disappeared, they're the same ones that are going to come back much more slowly as we need to phase in reopening retail and lodging and hospitality. If you're open 25% or 50%, you obviously don't need the same number of workers. And even if you're allowed to be open in those greater percentages, the rates that people are going to feel safe and comfortable going back to their normal routines of shopping and lodging and dining, it's just going to take a while for people to be behaving as though things are normal again, because right now they're not.
Yeah, it's a pretty tough picture. I mean, I guess, are there any things that can be, well, I'm going to save the question about, you know, any possible solutions or approaches that might mitigate some of these impacts for after we go to our bottom of the hour break, because I think it might be a fairly involved question and one which will take some thought and and so on from our guests, Lisa Senecal and Carrie Brown of the Vermont Commission on Women. I'm also interested in hearing from listeners out there if you are someone who has been wondering about this and has questions, or if you have any experiences that can shed a light on how this has gone, the economic impacts. How are individual families doing out there? I wonder, just in terms of, you know, one spouse and the other, is one spouse laid off, the other continuing to work? Has one spouse had to be home because there are school-age children who are not in school, but they are needing supervision while they're home, supposedly doing some classwork online or something? et cetera. Lots of individual stories, I'm sure, are being told out there, and we want to hear some of them after the bottom of the hour break here. We're going to be going to hear some CBS News and a couple words from our sponsors in just a moment. Before we do that, I do want to mention that at the top of the hour, after the Dave Graham Show concludes for the day and for the week, we will have another news conference with our governor, Phil Scott, and other top state officials. They've been briefing the media and the public every other day, basically Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, on what's going on with the state's response to the COVID-19 crisis. WDEV has been carrying these press conferences live, and we will do so again today. So when we wrap up here, don't touch that dial. We'll be going to the governor's news conference. We are heading into that bottom of the hour break. We'll continue our conversation with Lisa Senecal and Carrie Brown of the Vermont Commission on Women just afterwards. Stay with us, folks.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We're back, and my guests are Lisa Senecal. She is the chair of the Vermont Commission on Women, and Carrie Brown is the executive director of that organization. And we're talking about some of the really disparate impacts on women versus men in the COVID-19 crisis. The vast majority of healthcare workers are women. The vast majority of workers in industries which have largely shut down, including the restaurant industry, the hospitality industry, are women. And you go down this list of impacts, it really is quite striking when we see the way that things have played out unevenly here. That theme of things playing out unevenly, especially vis-a-vis women, Lisa Senecal, that is not a new thing, is it?
It's not. We still have a significant gender wage gap in Vermont, which is, I believe, around 16% right now. Women make about 80. White women make about 84 cents to every dollar that a man makes. And I think, you know, we haven't been talking that first segment at all about the disparities between white women and women of color. And I think it's really important for us to keep in mind that any of these issues that we're talking about that are having a disparate impact on women, it's hitting women of color in Vermont and around the country even harder than it is white women. So a lot of these statistics that we talk about, they're skewed because it's majority white women that end up in these numbers. And so I just want to make sure that we're being really mindful that a lot of the numbers when we're talking about them, we're talking about white women, and we've got a lot more work to do when it concerns women of color and people of color in general.
Right.
Thanks. It's just Lisa's making a really excellent point, and this is just a pitch for better data overall in the state. So we have, for instance, with COVID-19 cases, we know how many men and how many women. We know how many white people, how many people of color. We know how many people have the disease, how many have died. But what we don't know are things like how many black women have died from COVID-19, how many black men. And so we can look at national trends, and we can conclude some things or surmise some things about Vermont, but we need data that's disaggregated by race and gender across the board, but then also that we can cross-reference between the two so we can really know who is being impacted how.
Carrie, do we run into an issue sometimes, though, where the numbers are so small that you could raise some healthcare privacy concerns just by reporting statistics from, say, a small rural hospital, the number of people who have gone to that hospital and have died of COVID-related illness, and you say that, one 1% of them or 0.5% or something were, say, black men or black women. Community members sort of might be able to discern who that is. I mean, I've seen this concern raised in when talking about statistics relating to education, because so many times if you're talking about school disciplinary statistics, and you start to slice it by demographic groupings within a classroom, and certain demographic groups have one or two members in the classroom, it sort of gets hard to maintain any semblance of confidentiality, right?
Yeah, that's a real concern. And so that needs to be considered when the data is being reported. So perhaps it's not reported by hospital or by town. Perhaps it's reported at a state level.
Statewide,
there are ways, statewide level. I think there are ways to address that, and it's not an insurmountable obstacle, so we shouldn't let that stop us from collecting the data.
Yeah, and Lisa, I wonder, from your perspective, in terms of breaking this out, I mean, the other issue I can imagine some listeners might be having right now is that they might be saying, you know, the numbers are small enough in Vermont that when we sort of express our concern about things or take action to address certain issues, does it make sense to discount some demographic groupings because they just, you know, if you're trying to solve a problem, you solve 97% of the problem. Normally you're doing pretty well. I don't know if you get where I'm going with this, is there any sense there that that's why things are happening the way they are in terms of data collection?
I think a lot of the issues that we have with data collection is just that it's not habit. It's not top of mind for the way the data has been traditionally collected in Vermont, because we do have a small population of people of color. That is certainly no reason not to be collecting the data. And in instances where we do have privacy concerns because of the small numbers, if there isn't a way to report it, that doesn't mean we shouldn't be collecting it, because the data against itself for analysis purposes, that same group, we need to be able to see trends within it. And you mm-hmm. can't do that if you're not collecting the data. So
yeah.
Yes, it's a small percentage of people, but I think for too long we have had the people of color in our state and our country being an afterthought. And we have to stop doing that, and we have to make sure that any information that we're trying to collect that's going to improve any life outcomes for people, that we're collecting that same data for people of color.
And sometimes what you discover when you do collect the data is pretty remarkable, and it can be a real eye opener. I mean, I think now of data collection in law enforcement in Vermont here, and for a long time, I think that when you use the term afterthought, and that was kind of the way things were, and then suddenly in the last 10 years or so, certain individuals started to try to collect data on motor vehicle stops and so on, and the race of the driver, et cetera. And what showed up was, I mean, I remember going to a meeting with a bunch of leaders in the Vermont State Police back in the 2016, I think it was, as you know, when I was working as a reporter for the Associated Press, and the data released that evening were just, I mean, kind of, you know, you kind of slap your forehead, because it turned out that if you are a driver of color in Vermont, you were five times as likely to be stopped, to be pulled over than if you were a driver who was pulled over and you were a person of color, you were five times as likely to have your car searched. That's what it was. Than if you were a white driver. And as it turned out, white drivers are actually more likely to have contraband in the car. So it wasn't a very good law enforcement strategy for number one. And number two, it just showed a gigantic, racial disparity there, which would have been missed if people didn't start collecting the data and didn't start examining what it might mean. And I think a lot of the push for law enforcement reform vis-a-vis race in Vermont has come from those kinds of data collection efforts and people figuring out that, yeah, this actually is important information to gather, and it's going to inform changes we need to make. So, I mean, I just bring that up because it strikes me when we talk about this data collection issue as a really kind of important lesson I think a lot of folks got 5 or so years ago. Does that sort of carry through to this conversation here, would you say, Carrie?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in all ways, we need really good data. We need it to be collected. Lisa's spot on when she says that collecting racial data has just not occurred to people. And the same with gender data. You know, it's something that sometimes is collected incidentally but isn't reported on and isn't pulled out and looked at. And so I think we're seeing more awareness of that in Vermont, and we're definitely seeing more interest in the legislature in data that's disaggregated by demographics. And so that gives me a lot of encouragement.
Yeah, let's see. Let's look at COVID-19. And I mean, there are some health disparities as well. COVID-19 cases in Vermont by gender, 48% men, 52% women. How does that compare to the overall population? I know that women make up actually a slight majority of people overall in Vermont and in the world, right?
Yeah, it's pretty comparable. I mean, women are 51% of the people in Vermont, so 52% isn't really super far off from that. I think that, you know, as testing is more common, we're seeing the ratio kind of settle down into what it may be when all is said and done. Early on, we were seeing a higher number of cases among women. I remember a report from New Hampshire really early on that showed a huge disparity. Many, many more women were testing positive. And some of my colleagues and I were talking about this. Perhaps it was because healthcare workers were being tested at that point at a much higher rate, and they had a higher exposure. So things like that make it a little bit difficult to see what exactly is going on. But right now, we're not seeing a huge disparity in infection rates.
Yeah, here is some more interesting figures. And by the way, where can folks find this report? I mean, I think it's, if people are curious about this stuff, it's well worth going online to check it out. Lisa, can you tell us where would people find this? Is it on the commission website, I'm guessing?
It is. It's right on the homepage of the Women's Commission website. If you go to women.vermont.gov, you'll find this information and a whole lot more. I really encourage folks to take a look at what's there. And it's a completely revamped website, which we're extremely excited about. We are well into the 21st century now.
Hey, that's progress, right?
You can't say that about every government website. So I'm very pleased that we can say it about ours.
You can't say that about every private sector website either. So that's the... Hey, 47.1% of Vermont households headed by women with minor children under 5 years old are in poverty, whereas 14% of male-headed households with children under five are in poverty. That's a huge disparity. What's up with that? What's going on there?
Yeah. Go ahead, Lisa.
No, please.
Yep, Lisa, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. So this is, we will likely see that this may even worsen because of COVID, but these are current statistics pre-COVID. And a lot of that is attributable to women earning less money than men do, and the lack of flexibility that a lot of the jobs that women have in being able to take time off for childcare. So the poverty rates do go up. We see tremendous issues with child support. So there may not be the money getting to the children within that female-led household that should be there if child support isn't being paid at an adequate rate or isn't being paid at all. And the issue of childcare, has not just been a problem, it is now a much bigger problem than it has ever been. And that is going to very disproportionately hit women who are single head of households, but also women in two-parent households, because if women generally are the ones who earn less money than their male partner, it makes more sense for that family for a woman to be the one who stays home. And yep. that has lifelong economic negative impacts on women when they take time out of the workforce.
And that's also related to the ongoing issue of disproportionate household and family caregiving work that women do. And that's always been a big part of the wage gap. Women are just spending more time taking care of children and elderly parents and just the home in general. And so a national survey found that right now, or maybe a month or two ago when it was done, women were spending about 71 hours a week on home labor, whereas men were spending about 51 hours a week on home labor. And so there's already so much more of this is falling on women's shoulders, the work that has to be made up. And in our dashboard report, we mentioned the statistic that just 45% of men say they're doing the majority of school support work with their kids, but only 3% of women actually agree with that. So there's really some very different views about what needs to be done and how it's getting done. And wow. We have a link up on our website for people to submit their own stories about their experiences in COVID-19. And we've heard from mothers who are describing exactly the kind of situation Lisa was talking about, where they lose their child care and they find themselves overwhelmed with juggling taking care of their own children and working full time, and considering the idea that maybe somebody needs to step back from work, and it probably makes more sense for a mom to do it.
And meanwhile, being expected to step up their contribution to kids' education because the mm-hmm. kids are home and they're on computers and going to classes via Zoom, and somebody needs to, in many, many cases, kind of supervise all of that and make sure that when it's 10:30 in the morning and it's time for math class, the kid actually tunes in and does it. And, you know, it takes some what I've heard called emotional labor, if not just general sort of management and supervision and come on, get out of bed. It's time to get to your math class. So yikes. I mean, there are no magic bullet solutions here, but are there sort of ways that you would point to mitigate some of the problems we've been talking about the last half hour or 40 minutes?
Well, certainly child care is going to be, a huge ongoing issue. And I know the commission and a lot of wonderful organizations around the state are working with the state and the legislature to make sure that there is support for child care. But, it's going to continue to be a problem. So the more flexibility that businesses are able to provide all workers, but women in particular, I hope we've turned a corner to some degree with a lot of businesses who are able to have employees work remotely, recognize that that's not something that needs to end when we get beyond the pandemic. And that opens real opportunities, especially for working mothers and people in rural communities, if we can get high-speed internet throughout the state so everybody can take advantage of these new opportunities. And we need to make sure that in any of these conversations that are happening about recovery from COVID, that we have women leaders, women who are in the trenches doing the work, they need to be at the table. Because just as collecting data can be an afterthought, a lot of these issues that are unique or hit women harder can be afterthoughts unless there are women at the table who are really being hurt.
Well, I have to leave it there because that is about all the time we have. But Lisa Senecal and Carrie Brown. Lisa is the chair of the Vermont Commission on Women. Carrie Brown is the executive director there. I want to thank the two of you very much. And anybody can go to your website and have a look at this report and find out all sorts of interesting and maybe troubling data. Thanks very much, the two of you. That's about it for the Dave Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. Stay tuned now for the governor's news conference with other top state officials on the COVID-19 response. And we'll talk to you all on Monday. Have a good weekend, folks.